Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our big annual event celebrating women's leadership. I am Lois Romano. I'm co-chair of the board of directors, and I'm going to be brief because we have a pretty full program. On behalf of myself and my co-chair, Kathy Russell, Ambassador Kathy Russell, thank you all for your support and for being here today to honor three phenomenal women for their service to our country and for their contributions to national security. We all know that with more women at the top and more women at the table, better policy is made. It fosters global democracy, gender equality, and peace. That's our goal here, and it's what we do best. I would like to acknowledge our diplomatic colleagues who are here, both Americans who have served abroad, ambassadors, as well as foreign ambassadors who are here today. Could we get all the ambassadors and the deputy chief of missions to just stand for a second? You all have been critical to our mission from the beginning, and we really appreciate your support. I'd also like to thank current and former board members, including our founder and President Emeritus, Pat Ellis, who's here today. Can you all stand for a second? Can we get the board to stand real quickly? We couldn't do any of this without you. And lastly, thank you to our executive director, Kim Kaunhauser-Freeman, who holds it all together, and our program assistant, Megan Darlington, and all the interns and volunteers who have helped today. I would like to say just a brief word about journalists, and we are fortunate today to have two very accomplished women moderating our conversations. Journalists have been critical to the Women's Foreign Policy Group from the beginning. They have been supportive. They've loaned us their expertise, and they've moderated and made our programming better from the get-go. Recently, we have seen what's happening around the country, and it's troubling times for journalists. They are threatened everywhere just for really holding the government accountable. And now we see this happening in our own country, which reverberates globally. So on behalf of the organization, we'd like to thank all journalists for what you do. In closing, just a quick pitch. If you're not a member, we hope you'll consider it. It's a great, interesting group of people. We do a lot of wonderful programming, and we are mentoring the next generation. I'd like to turn things over now to board member Christy Rogers, who chaired this event and who we are so grateful to. She's a whirling dervish and has worked so hard for this. So let's give her a hand and she'll take it in from here.
I don't know, do I need to twirl when I come up here? The whirling dervish. I've been called many things, but that's not one of them, so thank you, Lois. As Lois said, I'm Christy Rogers. Good afternoon and happy December. Can we believe it? I can't. I'm stuck on the 4th of July, so I don't know what's happening. But I hope everybody had a wonderful Thanksgiving, enjoyed family, friends, or your dog, your cat, or yourself. Just had time to yourself, because we all do have something to be thankful for, even in these chaotic times. So I truly want to thank you all for being here today, because I know how busy each and every one of you are, and I want to thank you all for your efforts and everything you do, whether it's big and small, to actually help make this world a better place. And I know that sounds cheesy, but this world could use all the help we could get right now. Right? Amen? I heard that in the crowd. Because as we all know, when we open up the newspaper, when we turn on the cable news, we see that the United States and the world are facing challenging times, dangerous uncertainty, shifting alliances, and urgent crises that are striking at the core of nations. These perilous challenges range from escalating proxy wars, increasing election meddling, growing nuclear threat from rogue states, all the way through to, if that wasn't enough, through to the pervasive and rapidly transforming cyber threats, not just from criminals and organized crime, but also from nation states that don't just affect our national security, but they affect each and every one of us sitting here today and how to protect and secure and store our own data. So today, as we begin the program, we actually have, as Lois pointed out, we have three stellar national security leaders that are going to help us walk through these challenges and solve them all, right? Sue, Susan, and Andrea. So I'm just going to walk through the run of show a little bit. First, we are going to have a panel moderated by Elizabeth Bowmiller, who is a fellow board member and also the New York Times Washington Bureau Chief. She's had a stellar career with the New York Times. She's also covered the Pentagon, also covered the White House. And then when she was with the Washington Post, she served in New Delhi and around the world. So Elizabeth also has had such a stellar career. Elizabeth is going to be engaging in a discussion with Susan Gordon, so recently retired Deputy Director of National Intelligence, and also former Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, Andrea Thompson. So I think first, one thing we do, I can't forget this, because we all want to engage each and every one of you. We don't want just talking heads up here. So we're going to take questions from the audience. So there are pads of papers and pens at each table. We know this group is not shy, so think of your questions, write them legibly with your name on it, and then wave your hand, and one of our fabulous volunteers will come around and grab the card, and it will be called to ask a question. We'll have microphones in the audience. Okay, on with the program, and I have to put my glasses on. It's terrible. So bad. I didn't have to do this, like, 5, 10 years ago. It's terrible. So I'm going to just jump right in and introduce the two incredible role models we have today. I'm going to hold the introduction for Ambassador Susan Rice until later. But first, we've got Deputy Director of National Intelligence, Sue Gordon, as I mentioned. And Sue recently retired from the DNI in August. And I think there was a collective gasp, not just across the intelligence community, but quite frankly, across Washington, D.C. when she stepped down. She is incredibly credible, incredibly well-respected across the intelligence community. She's been serving in the national security across the IC and multiple disciplines for nearly three decades. I'm not going to say over three decades. Her leadership, knowledge, and ability to collaborate with others is unparalleled and will be greatly missed in that role. Next, we have the State Department's former Undersecretary of Arms Control and International Security, Andrea Thompson. Andrea Thompson also has served in the public sector in national security for nearly three decades. Like me, these two started when they were 12. So as like most of you, right? Prior to this role as undersecretary, Andrea served in the White House. She was deputy assistant to the president, and she was national security advisor to the vice president. Prior to that, she spent over 25 years in the military, serving in Iraq, Bosnia, Afghanistan, and was the J2, which is the intelligence directorate in Afghanistan. At State Department, she helped diplomatic policy for the United States around the world, meeting with leaders in various countries, traveling the globe nonstop on everything from emerging technologies to cyber to emerging threats. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Elizabeth. Thank you very much, and I hope you all enjoy your lunch.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Christy. Can you all hear me? Yes. Thank you all for coming, and thank you especially to Sue and to Andrea for doing this. We have exactly half an hour, which means this is going to be we're going to be dealing with nuclear capability and intelligence and the Trump White House, so I don't have a whole lot of time. It's a big topic to cover. So I'm going to do about 10 minutes for each of these two very impressive women and then open up to your questions. So please get some good questions ready. So let me start off with the news right off. Sue, you have briefed President Trump.
I have.
Who has famously talked about how he doesn't read a lot of intelligence briefings. Prefers perhaps maps sometimes to words. And you also had a very complicated exit from the Trump administration. So I'd like to just ask you again what it was like briefing the president, how you did it, how much he retained the information, and secondly, if you could. Oh, excuse me? Is it? Can you turn it up higher? Great. Okay, so do you want to tell us about that and also talk a bit about your exit from the White House?
Okay, so I had the greatest job ever. Intelligence is a lovely discipline that all you have to do is pursue the truth as hard as you can and then represent it in a manner that then policy can be formed. So I'll give you three things that are the same about this president for others that I briefed and three that are different. The three that are the same are everyone who I briefed is different. Some people, President Obama was a reader and just voraciously consumed it. JFK wanted 3x5 cards in his pocket. So the notion that you're going to have someone different who you're briefing, that you have to figure out a way to convey the information, because ultimately that's what you're trying to do. You are trying to present information in a way that is both heard and then can be used. So his difference. The other thing that's the same is intelligence is massively inconvenient. It actually typically steals some of the decision space of the president. So you're walking in there making things difficult because of what you're presenting, and you are limiting the choices because once it's heard, it is heard and it exists. And there's nothing different about this president. It is a foundational piece of his morning. It is a foundational piece of NSC meetings, whether that was 20 years ago or now. The third thing is every president for whom I've worked has wished intelligence could say things that it can't. Right? You wish that some piece of truth existed that would allow you to justify, and none of that is hard for the intelligence community to navigate. What's different about this president? Number one is he is the first in my experience that had no foundation or framework to understand what the limits of intelligence are, what the purpose of it was, and the way that we discuss it. So I do a lot of sports analogies. It's like playing pickup basketball with one runner, right? Everyone else knows how the game moves and plays, and you have one person that comes in and plays, and it's just so different. That in and of itself was different. He asked different questions. He pursued it differently. He had different trust. Because he is probably the first president that arrived with no framework and a world that has massively available information with infinite people offering opinion that oftentimes sound the same, but in fact are grittier because they don't have to have the same standard. And he's different because he is much more economic in the way he sees the world, and the intelligence community traditionally is much more political, military, purposely so. And so we were scrambling a bit to try and produce intelligence that was foundationally useful for someone who was interested in making trades and deals and be able to explain how we see the world when we were all the things that other people have been. So same and different. I found him actually kind of a fun brief because he was interactive. He would challenge you. And again, because the role of intelligence is to provide wisdom, clarity, and insight, you can't wish that the recipient were different from where they were. Your challenge is to present it in a way that it can be heard. So I think that was something, and I think everyone who's been in the Oval Office with this president would say that that was true.
Two follow-ups. Can you guys hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay.
And if you disagree with any of that, ask a question.
What kind of questions would he ask? And this is a weird question, but how long were the briefings? How long did they last?
Different time depending on the day, and I don't think that would...
I just lost us. I don't think that would surprise any of you that it differed on the day. We typically would brief two or three times a week religiously. I can't think of a week where we didn't have a session. It would always start out with us presenting a set of intelligence that we thought either were relevant to what he was doing or that needed to be heard. And I would say somewhere between 30 minutes and an hour would be typical.
And the questions he would ask, just an example?
I'm sorry, I just hadn't thought about that one. I would say two varieties. One, I don't think that's true. Right? And really, but but again, remember, intelligence is fundamentally a craft of uncertainty and of possibility, so that it doesn't put you off. It's trying to catch up to how you adjudicate the sources that led him to believe that and how you respond to it. So one is the, I'm not sure I believe that. And the other one is second and third order effects. Why is that true? Why are we there? Why is this what you believe? Why do we do that? Those sorts of things. And again, disproportionately with a economic bent to it.
Last question before I get to Andrea. Okay. Keep going. Which is that's your exit, your complicated exit. What do you know about it?
So, like snickering in the background, this is fantastic. So on the simplest level, the president who appointed me to the position of principal deputy, which is the senior most career intelligence advisor, ultimately decided that he was not comfortable with me continuing as the acting director when Dan stepped down and there was a gap. And if you're the third kid of a naval officer who has for her whole career professed that she was simply a steward of the community, not the community itself, you give a cheery aye-aye and you give the president the space. Do I think that he's wrong? Yes. Why wouldn't you? why wouldn't you want me to be in that role? But I think that on the simplest level, if once he decided, then you give him room to do that, because what you believe is the community is the strength, and that community continues to go in, and it's the women and men that are going to carry him forward. And I think that's what I told him.
Thank you for your candor. I'll be back to you in a minute. Okay, Andrea. The president just said in London at a NATO meeting that he has talked with Vladimir Putin about a broad new arms control treaty. He said, I have to say this is about an hour ago or 2 hours ago. Russia wants to make a deal on arms control. Russia wants to make a deal as recently as 2 weeks ago. We'll also certainly bring in China. We may bring them in later, or we may bring them in now. What is he talking about? And why is he saying that China is excited to join in? And I'm sure you, can you just expand on that?
Sure. Well, the refreshing thing about no longer being the undersecretary is I don't have to follow my Twitter feed. So if it happened in the last hour, I was probably talking to folks here in the room. But I can give some background on that because I did work it while at the State Department. And no surprise to the folks in the room, we have been in discussions with Russian counterparts. I've met multiple times with Deputy Foreign Minister Ryabkov to modernize our existing arms control agreements. Again, it's a better session for about another hour on violations of the INF treaty, but to modernize the systems that Vladimir Putin said, the novel systems that he's either already built or are in the process of building and testing. So we've had those discussions. We've been in talks with our Russian counterparts, again, to modernize the arms control treaties to reflect what is the current state. The violations from the past two administrations continued. We left a treaty in collaboration, consultation with our allies, and we're all in agreement that it needs to reflect the reality of today. And so those discussions are ongoing. We also need to have the systems that they're building be part of the treaty. Again, I left the department about 6 weeks ago, so if it happened in the last 2 weeks, I wasn't tracking that, but I can tell you what I did during my year plus as undersecretary, and then previous to that as the national security advisor for the vice president. With China, less optimistic. I have met with my Chinese counterpart multiple times in the construct of the P5, in the construct of the NPT, less so arms control to arms control across the table. I have raised it with my Chinese counterpart multiple times. If you want to be a responsible actor, you need to be at the table having discussions. They were not interested. And my personal assessment now is as a plain old taxpayer is there's not much incentive for China to come to the table.
But Trump keeps talking about it, and as one of my colleagues has pointed out, the Chinese have about 300 to 400 nuclear weapons, and wouldn't this just encourage them to
build more if he come if they came into the club.
Well, the important thing is dialogue. For those that know me, have heard me say it again and again and again. This starts with diplomacy, and it will end with diplomacy, and that's talking to one another. So if you're not having those discussions, we will never have an arms control treaty with China if we don't address it. We will never have a safer and secure world if we don't address it. So I hope that he continues to talk about it. It needs to be discussed. We are not in a good place with what our Chinese counterparts are doing with their weapon systems, with their policies writ large. Many of you here in the room are experts in those fields. So we're not going to solve that unless that door is open and we're talking. So I hope he does continue to talk about it, as I hope the women and men in this room continue to talk about it.
I was that, which brings me to my next question, which is people, you often hear in Washington that we are in a new Cold War with nuclear weapons. And do you see that as the case? And is there any way to... there's an arms race in place. Do you see any way to arrest it?
Yeah, I disagree. I disagree with that assessment. I think it's a bumper sticker. I think it bodes well for media sites and for pundits. What I would say is we have a different paradigm in technology, and Sue and I have talked about this as well. What technology is being integrated at more rapid pace? So is there an arms control race, or are we evolving our systems and processes as peers are, as adversaries are? So that is changing. What used to take generations or years and years now can happen in months and years. So I think that's what's happening, is we're integrating technology at a much greater rate. They're forming new alliances, and happy 70th to NATO. We're talking about the importance of the foundational alliances, but we have new alliances, as do our friends. So that's something that I think we need to talk more about, the agility of our systems. Hopefully we'll talk about that this afternoon on China as a whole of country, whole of system can integrate. And I'm not saying that we need to do it the Chinese way. What I'm saying is we need to be more agile in our system, as do our partners. And we've talked about that. And how do we do that, both as the public sector and as the private sector? We have much to gain from our relationships with the private sector when it comes to integrating technology.
Let me go back to Sue. You were at the CIA and DNI during the Russia investigation. So do you have any doubts that it was Russia and not Ukraine that interfered in the 2016 election?
So actually, I was at NGA.
Okay.
Okay. You know, I think that's important because I wasn't part of it. I think the intelligence community assessment on Russian interference in the election was an exceptionally good piece of analysis, and the decision to make it public was one of the best, most transformative decisions that the intelligence community made, because what we did was we talked about an issue of historic adversaries using a new modality to affect their longstanding policy of undermining society. And what we did was, by sharing it openly, we allowed the populace and the private sector to understand what they were facing, and you see a lot of good things coming from it. But I don't think there's anything that has happened in the 2.5 years since it was released that make me question its conclusions. Now, have over time others recognized what the digital environment can be used for in order to affect national interests? Yes, but that is, I don't think we've seen anything that changes the assessment that came out of that.
How much do you worry about what could happen in the 2020 election?
Well, because the making us not believe in ourselves, so fundamental to our society and any free society is the ability of people to believe that their vote matters. It is perhaps one of the greatest threat surfaces that we have, so it is going to be concerning. And because information moves at such a pace and such a volume, and we don't have as many mechanisms to deal with it, I think it's going to be concerning. The distance we have traveled, not only between 2016 and now, but in 2018 to now, in terms of getting state and local governments to understand it, what has happened at DHS in order to be really engaged, what's happening with the private sector and the populace, I think gives me great hope that we are much better prepared, but this is always going to be a threat surface that we are going to have to pay attention to.
Another question for you. Where does he has this inherent distrust for the intelligence community. I think we've seen that for 3 years now. Mm-hmm. Why?
So I'm not sure I'm going to agree with the top line premise. I think we have, if we had a longer conversation, we could talk through the whole range of issues that this nation has addressed, and I would tell you that intelligence has been at the bedrock level of a lot of things, of those issues, and the president has received that information on China. I think this president has taken intelligence on China and used it to better effect than many presidents. I think the Russian interference, the way that it has played out, and what he infers its implication is to the legitimacy of his position, is what causes that to be a hotbed issue. But don't take away that the president doesn't listen to, rely on intelligence in general. That is a trust issue. And his difference means that he has to work harder to adjudicate the difference between what his intelligence community is telling him and what others who sound like they're in the same domain tell him.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that means, yeah. Going back.
You don't seem like you buy it.
No.
But look at this face. I take a polygraph.
That's right. Trust me, with the government. Trust
right.
Me.
So. Going back to cyber, when we were speaking on the phone, you mentioned the Bureau of Cyberspace Security, which is yet to be stood up at the State Department, but it's a drop in the bucket compared to what's the Cyber Command at the Pentagon. But what is the reason for the State Department to stand up a Bureau of Cybersecurity? Why does the State Department need such a bureau? I mean, I know the answer, but we should talk
about it. Sure, yeah. Well, the State Department, the country needs the bureau, is the short answer, because leading diplomatic policy discussions isn't CyberCom. It's not the Pentagon. Diplomatic cyber discussions and AI discussions and quantum discussions are what the State Department does. We've done it, and it's not new. We have professionals, civil service and foreign service in our ranks that are doing that now. But it's across different sections of the State Department. One of the first things I did as Undersecretary, I raised it with the Secretary and said, this is foundational to what we do. Whether it's discussions with NATO, Indo-PAC, here at home, it has a framework of emerging technologies, and we're behind. You know, when I go to Estonia, when I go to Australia, when I go to across the globe, other countries are already doing this. And you said, yeah, let's stand it up, tell me what it looks like. We laid it out, how many people, spaces, functions, engaged with, again, folks in the room, engaged with industry, engaged with the chamber, engaged with the Hill, engaged with partners. We designed it, we worked through it, we presented the congressional notification this summer, and it has been there since. But when you talk to folks, they're like, oh my gosh, we need this. So if you're in the room and you have contacts with the SFRC and the House Foreign Affairs Committee, it's that important. So we have the functions of it, we have the leaders that are doing it. When you're having those discussions on 5G, kind of current events, you know, that's DAS Rob Strayer and his team. We are traveling the globe, meeting with partners and allies, going, this is when you bring companies into your network, primarily Chinese companies, here are the vulnerabilities you have within your network. And it's an interagency message. It's not just the State Department. It'll have the DoD framework. It'll have the intelligence community. But we're having country-to-country diplomatic discussions. That is solely under the purview of the State Department. So hope is not a method. We have done the work. The people are there. When you talk about recruiting the next generation of leaders, again, I look around the young people in the room, they recognize they want to serve. They want to serve in their diplomatic community, and they're passionate about technology. This is a perfect fit. I've talked with leaders in Silicon Valley who want to serve, and how do we get, again, some unique relationships? Can we do a fellowship where you come from a tech company for a year? We help, you know, give you some exposure of policy, and you help us with the technical piece and return. That's all doable. We've started a fellowship with Georgetown, with the other CSET, but with Jason's team over there, we have a Georgetown fellow that will be working AI at the State Department and then return. We need, again, back to agility and modernization of our policies. We need to get it done.
I want to ask two more questions, one of each about just for the young leaders in the room, and then I have a bunch of questions here from the rest of you. At the age of 28, you were in the Situation Room briefing George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan about Soviet missile capability. Can you tell the crowd how you got there at that age?
Okay, so...
how do you do it?
First, you join. I would say best first 5 years, best first 10 years of anyone's career is spent in national security. One, the purpose is great, and two, you carry more responsibility than your peers. So my colleagues at Duke, while I was briefing the president, they were working on a bushing at General Electric, right? So just carrying responsibility young. So the way you get there is you accept the job, you work hard, you put your nose down, you're excellent or within the parameter of excellence, and when your moment comes, you do a good job. You know, what's interesting, as I was thinking about, Elizabeth had told me she'd asked that question, how does a 28-year-old stand in front of President Reagan? And President Reagan and Vice President Bush, and it was Cap Weinberg, I mean, it was a who's who around that table. You know, they didn't ask very different questions than the president asked, just in a different modality. They asked why it was on Soviet space program, and why the Soviet space program was so much more robust and so much stronger, particularly in the civil arena, than the U.S. space program. And so they looked at each other like, why did we give up the Saturn V? Why are we doing that? Why don't we have that same thing? So in a weird sort of way, you get there because you come into this community, you learn to carry the weight of responsibility, you are surrounded in a community that values expertise, so they send the right person, not the right level. And then you understand the problem that you're addressing, and you hopefully brief it in a way.
Were you nervous?
No. I don't know why. I don't know why. It was so much fun. So for those of you, and if you want to say for someone who left under complicated circumstance, in a world that seems to have gone crazy, where the trust between the political elements and the careerists and the bureaucratic elements of our government seems to be really frayed, and hyper-partisanship and irresponsible social media, would I say to you that this is the best place to be? It is. Maybe no one's going to be there for 40 years anymore. I don't think that's the way, because national security is more in and out than that. But man, that feeling of great purpose and weight of responsibility is a great way to grow up.
Thank you.
Okay. Andrea, I don't know what you were doing at 28, but it was something important, because I'm looking at this biography here, and you were all over the world. So how did you do this?
Well,
where do you start?
I echo the comments from my good friend Sue. So I was doing the math in my head when you asked her where she was when she was 28. I think it was a company commander leading military intelligence soldiers at Fort Lewis, Washington, if I've done my math correctly, studying the Indo-Pacific. So again, it's called to service. Folks go, well, did you want to be in the military? Do you have a family history? I was a journalism major. Went to the University of South Dakota to be a journalist and play basketball. And then took a military science class because it was a free social science elective. Because I was a journalist and knew nothing about the military. And then they asked me if I wanted to rappel off the library at homecoming. I'm like, I'm in. So rappelled off the library. But no, I was surrounded with people that I was learning from, people that I respected, people that I quite candidly wanted to be like when I grew up. And thought, okay, I'll join the Army. Can I go to Europe? Yes. Can I be military intelligence? Yes. So again, work hard, surround yourself with good people. And as my mom said, I think at probably the 10-year mark, so are you thinking about reenlisting? I'm like, Mom, I think I'm in for the long haul. But because I had fun and learned about myself personally and professionally every day. And so folks go, how did you get into government? Called to service. Yep. I did not seek out the job with the vice president. I got cold called by the vice president's team in November. I had retired Halloween, October 31st of 16. I retired from 28 years in the Army, and then got a call, and a better story over a cold beer, but with the whole room of new friends. But I told my husband, I said, I'm just going to go in for the interview. My parents will be really happy, and it's a great experience. I'm meeting the new vice president of the United States. And then they offered me the job in January, and I took it as a call to service. So you never know where that path is going to go. I know I wanted to be around people I learned from. and have fun doing it and work hard, and it's a passion. And so when folks go, did you want to be, you know, serving the white? It's a call to service. That's how my family interpreted. I have been asked by my country to serve again, and I will say yes.
Thank you.
We'll answer in tweets.
What?
Yeah, we'll answer your questions in tweets so we can be mindful of time.
Can you give us a snapshot of this is the uprising in Iran? Can the street sustain its this movement? And the other question I had, which was part of that, which was what does Donald Trump actually want in an Iran deal?
I'll let him answer that.
Okay, but yeah.
Is it sustainable? The maximum pressure has, the economic, we're seeing some results of that. I will tell you again, this is not the former undersecretary, but maybe the former intelligence officer. That is a resilient regime. That is a resilient regime. So I hope the power of the people. We do not want a nuclear Iran. They're, like I said, whatever it comes to the a deal. But at the end of the day, the pressure is having some effect. But we do not want a nuclear Iran.
Here's another question. Last year, I was lucky to organize the first U.S. business mission to Baghdad in almost a decade. Next year, I'll be returning on a more frequent basis, provided the security situation improves. What is your best piece of advice, I guess for both of you, for young professional women who do work in environments with challenging security circumstances?
Understand what you're walking into, and if it feels wrong, it is.
That's interesting. That is very interesting. What if it always feels wrong?
It won't. It won't. That's not as glib as it sounds.
Yeah.
I would say you're going to go into that circumstance and there will be a structure around it. So you're going to want to understand that structure as you go into it. But I will also just say on a personal level, anytime you go into a difficult circumstance or just be aware of your surroundings. And if something feels wrong, it probably is. And make a move.
Give the same advice.
Same advice. In fact, back to being a young 23, 24-year-old as a first sergeant, it said, Lieutenant, if it feels wrong, it probably is.
Interesting.
That's good parenting advice,
yeah.
too.
Good parenting
advice.
That really works.
If I may just add one other thing, one other bit, though, is one other bit is self-awareness. So know your strengths and know your weaknesses. And know, again, back to mentorship, if it's new to an area, like I said, if it was a colonel going into Iraq, or into Afghanistan, you don't know everything. And seek out those folks that are around you. And again, know where you're strong, but know where you need to work and seek those out to help you along.
One last thing. Is there anything you want to ask each other?
Best day.
Best day?
In your job.
Oh, my job.
In this last epic of a shockingly brilliant career.
Best day.
That's what I'm going to say.
I guess they tell you, if the first answer that comes to mind is the right answer. Got me through undergrad anyway. One of the best days was in Estonia. And again, back to mentorship and technology. And I was asked to come to the YSI camp. Five countries. Estonia. Was it Estonia, Georgia, U.S. And I apologize, I'm off the top of my head. Anyway, five countries, girls between the ages of 16 and 17, two-week public-private partnership with the State Department and industry, girls that are coding, building drones, networking across, and to sit in that room, the reason I think is because I FaceTimed my husband that night, and he goes, I don't know what you did at work today, but you are just beaming. And I said, I sat in a classroom with a next generation of global leaders, and I felt like part of me was given back, but I probably got more than I gave that day. So my day in Estonia at the YSI camp.
Your best day? Last question? Is that what you want to ask?
Best day.
Oh, this is so cheesy. You're just going to have to accept this is who I am. Every day when I remember that I got to say this sentence, the other day when I was in the Oval Office talking to the president. And I say that because I never tried to forget what I got to be a part of. And for the third kid of a naval officer with a degree in zoology and a captain in basketball to be at that moment and to carry the hopes and dreams of a community who felt so strongly about it, every time I remember that I could say that, it was my very best day.
Thanks to both of you. Thanks to all of you.